Well, it's a one for the money, two for the show, which just happens to be Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk, rather fortunately. I'm Paul McInnes, and this is How We Do. Jeff Barrow, Portishead Supremo, returns to the pod to discuss his latest project, Beak. We'll review new music from Yeysayer, Matthias Aguayo and Tune Yards and Singles Club. We'll have the thoughts and opinions of you. But first, it's the nation's favourite haberdashers-turned-folk band. Yes, form a polite queue, and someone will be with you in a minute. It's Mumford & Sons.
I won't let you choke on the noose around your neck, and I'll find strength in pain, and I will change my ways. I'll know my name as it's called again.
That was The Cave by Mumford & Sons, who are both interviewed and playing live on the pod this week. Now, they might not actually have any haberdashery skills, but Mumford & Sons have been quickly gaining a reputation for rich, emotional folk music. Here to tell us a little bit more about the band is someone rich and emotional in her own right. Yes, Rosie Swash.
I wish I was more rich and less emotional.
But you could be rich in kind of human qualities.
Oh,
and just
yeah,
life.
I didn't think of that.
Little birds
showing
kind of nestling on your
up.
Shoulder and things like that.
This is very true.
Yeah. So tell us about Mumford.
Well, I have to admit that because they come from what is a media construct of the new folk scene around London, which is like Noah and the Whale, Laura Marling, not really my kind of thing. I'd kind of dismissed them at the beginning of this year when they started to emerge. And then I gave their debut album a proper listen, and it is absolutely blinding. It's more kind of bluegrass roots inspired music. It's incredibly dramatic and has this powerful four-part male harmony that makes it quite distinctive from the rest of the stuff that you could compare it to. The band came in earlier this week so I could ask them all about their glorious LP Sigh No More, and one of the things we discussed was the influence of American literature on the band, particularly that of John Steinbeck, he of Grapes of Wrath, Mice of Men. So here is Marcus Mumford, singer-songwriter of the group, explaining why he finds Steinbeck's writing so inspirational.
I think he's one of the few writers that I've read that really hates generalising America. Mm. Like, he doesn't generalise even the American dream so much. Because America's so huge, and we've experienced that from touring there a little bit and being there a bit. I was born there. That it's just such a vast place that you can't really generalize it that well. So he's very good, I think, at picking out the specifics in certain communities. So he's really good at writing about American communities, but also the language he uses to describe family and describe the land. And also, like, he really has real compassion as a writer, I think, and he can pick off right and wrong in scenarios and then bring that out. And I really get excited by the way he writes about right and wrong, and the way people treat each other in sort of a Western sort of scenario.
Rip the earth in two with your mind, and seal the urge which ensues when brass wire.
Because that definitely feeds into your songwriting.
Yeah.
There's a lot of very grand themes, and a lot about which you get in a lot of Steinbeck's novels as well, about taking responsibility for your actions,
yeah,
or sort of being faced with responsibility. Why do you think that speaks so much to one who is so young?
I guess it's because I think part of becoming a man really is learning to deal with your mistakes and the faults in your character. And I think Steinbeck, especially as a writer, is really good at unfolding that, but also, like, learning from it. And so some of his characters never learn from it, and you see their destruction.
Weep for yourself, my man. You'll never be what is in your heart.
In songs like Little Lion Man, is that particularly autobiographical, or is that you taking on...
All of the songs are autobiographical, in some way, shape or form.
And the bluegrass feel of the music, is that all tied in with the Steinbeck influence, or is it... No.
That's a different thing, actually.
Oh, really?
Okay. I mean, the sort of sound we make, away from the sort of lyrical content, the actual sort of sound we make is a product of all the music we've listened to, which does, you know, involve a lot of American music, as well as a lot of English music, and everything from jazz and blues to country and folk. and also the instruments we're playing, like Winston on the banjo, me on the double bass, so it's really a sum of its parts.
Tremble for yourself, my man, you know that you have seen this all before. Tremble, little lion man, you'll never settle any of your scores.
And what about this kind of idea of, you know, you guys, Laura Marling, Johnny Flynn, it's been referred to as new folk.
It's been referred to as a lot of things.
Oh, what are the other things it's been referred to as?
None of them I agree with, so none of them I'm going to give any airplay.
Does it? But the thing that strikes me is that you guys are, it is actually about friendships and playing with each other, whereas a lot of these, when, you know, a music journalist comes up with a term for a new movement and just lumps any old people into it, but you are actually friends with the people.
Yeah, that's so true. That so is called. The uniting factor. And
I think the problem we have might be that we personally hear a massive difference between us and some of the people we've been lumped in with. Mm. Like, but we're friends, so
I guess people are more are enjoying like more rootsy based music. I don't think it's just exclusively folk. So it's definitely the point we try to get across is that it's not exclusive, which the word scene can often sort of conjure this image of sort of people trying to be more cool than they can be able to play their instruments or whatever. And I think it's really, and something, the scene is always like, seems exclusive to me, but the whole point of this and the reason we're here as a band at all, we just think it's like, we love touring. It's all about touring for us. You know, recording the album was exciting and it was fun and it was great to be able to work on this bigger tapestry, etc. But the live gigs are what it's about for us. And so who you tour with really matters because they rub off on you. It's like, and in the same way that you sort of, you play what you listen to. Like my jazz drum teacher when I was like 12 made me buy Kind of Blue by Miles Davis because he said, you play what you listen to. Mm. And my brother recently told me, you know, you write what you read, so it's important what you read. And I think it's the same with, you know, whatever you're around rubs off on you. Mm. And we're pretty impressionable fellows. so I'm sure if we toured with a ska band, we'd start getting some trombones involved.
That's
pretty
an
heavily.
Interesting idea.
We're open to that.
But at the same time, we also do know what we love, and we love, you know, we love melodies and lyrics and harmonies and beats, but I wouldn't say we're exclusively bluegrass. And my hand told my heart, let
love grow. And you guys recorded your album before you had a deal, is that right? Where did you record it and how did you fund it? And
we sort of paid for it.
We're all really rich.
Which really helped.
Daddy paid for it.
No, we did it. We did do it before the label, which is great because it meant there was no sort of A&R. And then creatively, it was very much our own. And we met with Marcus Dravs, the producer, after having already worked with a couple of other producers. But when we met Marcus, we knew he was the man for the job. And making of the album was really, really easy. And it was a little bit stressful because we were sort of trying to negotiate some sort of record deal while we were in the studio. And
because realistically, we did need someone to pay for it really badly.
We were sort of making it, and every day we were like, how are we going to pay for this?
But it was good of them actually to trust us like that. Not many, I haven't heard of many record labels that will pay retrospectively for an album that they're not involved with, and which is why we signed a licensing deal. So we own all the music, we own all the copyrights to everything, and we get to approve everything. Mm. So we still don't have any money, but we own the copyright, whatever that means.
Apparently it's a good thing.
Oh,
I'm hungry.
I'm hungry.
The effects of having had the reasonable success of the first album now actually being on a label as opposed to doing it yourself. Do you feel like those, are you going to just try and push those things out?
We'll probably get really good musicians to come and play on it.
On your behalf.
Yeah, we'll start losing weight and wearing suits and brushing our hair.
Get a bit proggy.
Yeah, and then get really proggy. Yeah, probably get in Mark Ronson as well.
Oh, great.
So we're going to India in January, so we'll probably come back with some sort of Ravi Shankar type fellow.
Yeah.
Some sitar players.
I'm going to be George.
That was Marcus Mumford and Ted Duane from Mumford & Sons, and their debut album, Sign No More, is out now. We'll have a live version of the song Tim Shell at the end of the show.
Fantastic. Is Mumford his real name then?
Marcus Mumford. I assume it's not a stage name. It would be a little...
Because I just always associated with Mumrath and Thundercats and that. Okay, thanks, Rosie. Nice interview. And we will have Mumford & Sons back in the pod later on. Stay tuned for that. Or indeed, just skip to it now and come back afterwards. That's what you can do with digital. Singles Club. That's what we call it. And here to help us discuss a selection of the latest music is Observer Music Monthly's Gareth Grundy. Gareth, good to have you on board.
Hello there.
So tell us something nice that's been happening to you this week, Gareth.
Tell us something nice that's been happening to me. Oh, I'm going to see Staff Bender Bilili tonight.
Wow.
The Congolese band, they all suffer from polio and they all ride around. They live in Kinshasa in not great conditions, it has to be said.
So you feel better about your life.
And it makes everybody feel a bit better about themselves. And they're fantastic.
And this is what Casper Llewellyn-Smith edited, Casper
went to Kinshasa for a couple of days, I think an interesting couple of days. And these, you know, as polio sufferers in a place where there is, you know, not a lot of medical care, you know, they live in not great conditions, shacks, basically, kind of, you know, rubble, you know, makeshift homes, but they are kind of amazing musicians. I think they all lived in a home for polio sufferers and it burnt down or fell down, and you know, there's no infrastructure in the Congo, and a lot of the money they're making is supposed to go back into sort of helping themselves out. And this is their first UK show. They played in Paris before, I think.
I'm going to refrain from making a cynical remark at that point.
They're staying in the Premier Inn down the road.
I was going to say, how long before they start heading down to the Carlton?
They were all outside this morning having a fag.
Aww.
In matching red Staff Bender Bilili jackets.
I don't know how I didn't spot that.
But I imagine it's quite a lot colder here than in the Congo.
I think at 8:30 in the morning, our eyes are firmly fixed on the floor. Right, let us start Singles Club, and we're going to start with your choice, Gareth. And this is Matias Aguayo and a Roller Skate. That was Roller Skate by Matias Aguayo. Born in Chile and resident in Germany, Matias Aguayo has the passport of a Nazi war criminal in reverse, but is in fact a recording artist for trendy techno label Compact. This is the lead track from his upcoming album Ay Ay Ay. Getting the Latino flavour in there. And Aguayo has already been described as the Bobby McFerrin of the 21st century by me.
I was going to say, who described him as that?
Eminent commentator, me. Take it away, Gareth.
I like the Nazi war criminal job, but I think even more in keeping with that, I think he lives in Buenos Aires now. He did live in Germany, he lived in Cologne, where Compact were based. He works in France, basically lives all over, and he's part of a crew that throw palo parties in South America. The album was recorded in Chile and Uruguay, I think.
And Buenos Aires as well.
I mean, it's I love the voice. I mean, there's elements of a kind of one-man TV on the radio in there, what he does with the vocals, bit of the kind of Latin side of David Byrne's solo output. It's just not like anything else really around at the moment. And there's obviously a little bit of that kind of Latin thing coming back in with that Vampire Weekend single or Chatter. You know, Diplo's going on about soccer and stuff. It's like, I guess next year, you know, we'll all be pretending that there's a Hispanic element to our lives.
We will eventually run out of continents to plunder, I think, musically. But one thing that's interesting about this is that it's still, despite it's a very vocal, it's obviously a very vocal track and so many layers of his own voice in there, but it still has the structure of dance music.
Yeah, I mean, he made a lot of kind of minimal techno records on his own and with other people, and that, yeah, it's all layers, it's all loops, you know, he's just looping his own voice rather than drum tracks.
Yeah, so gem, which does make it something original. Rosie?
Well, it's funny because we were talking just last week about, you know, magpie music, which to me, this sounds very much like that. The looping of his vocals right at the bottom could almost be sort of pre-Beatles American rock and roll kind of, you know, almost doo-wop in a way. It's just, so when you first hear that, you've no idea what's going to come next. I think the melody's brilliant. It's absolutely lovely. Where it does fall down for me is because dance music, good dance music, does know how to progress a track out of quite basic elements and keep it feeling exciting, this track doesn't quite go anywhere. Where I feel like it could, you're just waiting for that other huge beat to come in or something like that. But I do think it's very good.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have those. Yeah, you're right. It doesn't have the kind of crescendos and crashes and builds again.
No, I mean, the album's basically a pop record.
Yeah,
it's kind of a series of tracks basically like this, and it works as a kind of series of grooves, and it's his pop side, really.
Yeah, and it's really worked its way into me because I've been listening to this quite a lot. That the one thing about it I can't escape though is I could see it being quite amenable or quite suitable for adaptation for TV advertising. With some kind of continental car or new
mobile
smartphone, yes, with people doing collaborative things in a cityscape.
I agree. You can see some clever ad people thinking, well, you know, this could be a pan-European soundtrack.
But I suppose that's no reason to hate on something when it hasn't even happened yet.
No, and I like the fact he sings in this kind of weird mix of Spanish and English and kind of slurs it all together.
I like that too.
Good job then. Good job, Matias Aguayo. That is Roller Skate and it's out now. But the album III is coming out soon. Second track on Singles Club is Hetari by Tune Yards. Now that was Tune Yards with Hetari. Tune Yards is one-woman band Meryl Garbus. She composes music from found sounds, spells Tune Yards with a wide variety of capital and lowercase letters, and, it seems fair to say, is not shy of appearing a little eccentric. As for what Hetari means, there appear to be three options. One, it's a computer program that simulates old Ataris. Two, it's a John Wayne film about the dangers of going on safari. Or three, it's a company that makes mobile phone cards in Thailand. Your guess is as good as mine. Rosie?
Well, I actually chose this because I'm a big fan of mobile phone cards from Thailand.
Well, they're cool, aren't they? They are really cool. And if you're in Thailand, you can make phone calls, which is a definite bonus.
No, obviously I didn't do that. I was in Mali a couple of years ago and I watched a pair of Inuit throat singers performing face-to-face in front of me. It's a very strange experience. And it's got a very distinctive sound, which the beginning of this track instantly reminded me of. And the rest of it is just, it could almost be an old, you know, field recording that you've just found, which is obviously exactly what she's trying to do. But it's not quite there. I think the drums in particular are quite fashion forward, they might say.
Directional.
You know, I guess I can't really sit there and talk about Gareth's selection not being, you know, not really going anywhere and then pick this without saying it kind of does the same thing. But I wanted to pick it as well because I think it's representative of why the label 4AD, which has put Tune Yards' album out, is a really great little label. I remember a long time ago when Select magazine was still going, they put out a compilation, a 4AD compilation. It was the first time I'd heard bands like The Hope, Blister and Cocktail Twins. And I just remember thinking then, and the same thing I thought now, is that sometimes they put out artists who wouldn't fit anywhere else. And then you think, yeah, of course they're on 4AD. And that's kind of what I thought when I heard this. It doesn't really make much sense why you would put this out commercially. But it sounds great to me, and that's why I like 4AD, and that's why I like this.
I know I'm going to get this wrong, and we can obviously cut it out if I do, but TV on the Radio, 4AD?
They are, yeah. Speaking as someone that worked at Select and probably worked on that issue, is old enough to have bought a lot of 4AD records in the 80s.
That was their heyday, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, but I'm giving away my slight OAP status here. Yeah, I think the revival of 4AD the last few years is kind of brilliant, really. It's very much in keeping with the spirit of the original record, which is to find a home for stuff that doesn't have a home anywhere else. I love this. I thought it was fantastic. I like the fact it didn't go anywhere. Mm. and it's obviously, you know, it's all vocals. We're having a vocal week this week. And she toured with the Dirty Projectors, didn't she? And I can see why, because they have this kind of indie sensibility take on American R&B, and it comes out in a kind of ramshackle way. And she's got a kind of similar approach, but applying it to African music. I think she lived in Kenya for a while, didn't she? And there's some of the, I think the middle verse is in what sounds like it could be, you know, Gikuyu, which is the Kenyan language.
Check you out. Yeah, I was going to go some regional dialect, but you got a specific name.
That's Google for you.
Are any of the vocal samples in there going to be hers? This is just an idle question. I thought
it was all her that she. I mean, she records with voice manipulation and software. That's how she makes it. She does it all herself, so I assume it's all her.
It's all her.
She used to be a puppeteer, didn't she? Puppets is her thing, or was her thing. So I don't know if the live show involves a bit of puppetry, maybe. That would be great. Wouldn't that be great if there was puppetry?
And all in keeping with the branding, I think. But the one thing I'd like to go in from the kind of resident percussive obsessionist is I love the beat on this. And I was reading something in one of the reviews, I think it's on Pitchfork, saying that a lot of the stuff that she records on this digital recorder, the sound, it's too loud, the levels go wrong and things start to glitch. And I think you can hear that just on the edges of each bar. There's a kind of a noise which sounds like something's just popped, but it's cut together in such an effect that it really kind of adds an extra drive to the song. Big fan of this too. So the only person left exposed to a potential bad review, it's me, and that would be Ambling Help by Yesayer. Now, kid, I know I haven't been a perfect man, and I'm avoided doing things I know I can. But if I've learned one thing, the tattoo on my arm will burn into my thumb. It would be bad. You must stick up for yourself, son. Never mind what anybody else done. That was Ambling Out by Yesayer. Rounding out a trio of weirdness this week, a Yesayer, basically a cross between a bunch of hippies and a bunch of noodling proggers with the long hair to match. This is the first single from their second album, Odd Blood, which may or may not be a rock opera about a haemophiliac. I'm going for not, but, you know, we'll leave it open. I like a band that's not embarrassed to shamelessly ditch their sound in the hope of selling more records, and that's why I salute Yesayer today. Basically, their debut album, All Our Symbols, it was interesting. It got good vibes on this pod, but it never really flew commercially, but also, in my personal taste, because it put soundscaping before songwriting, so you could always hear interesting things on a track, but you could quite often spend 5 minutes waiting for it to happen. This is a far poppier track than anything that was on that first album, and to me sounds like the touring the band did with the very successful MGMT has rubbed off on them a bit. I think it's got that kind of structure, it's got a similar melody, although you can also hear a bit of Animal Collective in there and TV on the Radio as well. It's got a really catchy melody, as I say, it's got a powerful chorus, and it rolls along at a great pace, but it still has the room for the noodly Yesayer. So there's some sort of musical plumbing going on at the beginning and then lots of wibbliness at the end. And I think that's the right direction to go. If you're going to kind of say, all right, we're going to tighten ourselves up and we're going to go for a bit more melody and a bit more pop punch, it makes sense, I think, to still keep the ingredients that you enjoy, or keep the musical elements that you enjoy composing in the first place. So I enjoy this record, and I salute Yesayer for their endeavours. Gareth.
I'm going to say a bad thing. I'm going to say a very trendy Level 42.
Now that's what I was trying to think of. I was trying to think of who it reminded me of.
Now,
but I don't think that's a bad thing. I was wondering.
That just makes me think of, in the back of it, looking back, it's so bizarre with Joseph and Emily, all the things we are.
Do you refer to them, like all obsessive Level 42 fans, as the 42? Which is what they are known as.
The 42nd parallel. No, I don't, actually. You're right, I don't like Mark King and his work. But explain, elaborate on that point a little.
I mean, I quite like the way they've rounded out their sound, but they have this, I quite like the first record, but it's just that kind of nagging, it's like kind of light funk, really, despite the kind of trendy clothes. And it just, that always pops into my head, Level 42, whenever I hear them.
And before this, on the first album
a little less so on the first album, but this one a lot more.
Because that was all sort of a bit of Afropop and Tuareg kind of
I don't hear quite so. I mean they talk a lot about having a sort of African influence, but I don't really hear it in them.
No,
I hear more of a kind of white funk thing, really. I heard a lot more African stuff in the tune out stuff. That was a lot more of a kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I don't think... I'm not sure this is the... I'm not sure they're going to be so African this time. And I think if I was to be cynical about it, I would think, well, when they were making their first album, African sounds were all the rage, and now they're kind of the following on from this.
And that 80s light funk is in Brooklyn.
Yeah. And actually, I've seen them live, and actually their live performance catches neither of those.
Are you talking yourself out of your own tune?
Well, I now feel bad because he's made a point that resonates with me.
I think I'd like to see the return of the White Sock in Williamsburg. That would be brilliant, wouldn't it?
Oh, God, I'm sure they've got them on already. Rosie?
I like it. I'm just going to put that out there. But I was trying when I was listening to it to pin the correct 80s reference on it. And even at the very beginning, before the vocals came in, had like Flock of Seagulls in my mind. I was like, who is it? I don't think it's that far away from what they did in the first album. I think that they've got a, you know, they've got a very anthemic, memorable chorus, which they only had on about two songs on the first album, definitely. I think it's okay. Like, I just don't really have a problem with the kind of unabashed revelry in making, you know, making a real rip-off of an 80s record. I just think it sounds great. And I like Yay Sayer. I really like them. I mean, I get the point about, you know, about maybe misunderstanding. I get the point about them being a bit contrived. I do think they're a bit contrived. That's definitely the case. But I think they do it well. And I'm all right. I'm at peace with the fact that I like a level 42.
Yeah, it makes me think again about Julian Casablancas and what we were talking about with him. And that there is, you know, there is a level of contrivancy of things being contrived. But as long as it works in the end, not going to complain. Okay, Yay Sayer and their Amblin Alp is available to download now from Yay Sayer. And that's Yay as in him, oldie Yay. YEASAYER.net. Okay, you've heard what we have to say on the matter. Now shove your opinions under our digital noses on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Tell us what you think of Yay Sayer, Tune Yard, Matias Aguayo, and these other tracks that are out to buy next week.
I thought I saw you in the rusty hook, huddled up in a wicker chair. I wandered over for a closer look and kissed whoever was sitting there. Close, and she held me very tightly till I asked awfully politely, please, can I call you her name?
Arctic Monkeys, Cornerstone Limited. Florence and the Machine, You've Got the Love. Lady Gaga, La La La, Bad Romance. And T.I. and Mary J. Blige, Remember Me. Okay, that is Singles Club. Gareth, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
On this dark, wintry day.
Indeed.
And sharing your thoughts. A very learned and elucidatory thoughts, as ever. So thank you very much for that. Okay, that's it for Singles Club. Next on Music Weekly, it's the multi-talented Mr. Jeff Barrow. That's Barrow Gurney by Beak, the latest project from Jeff Barrow. He's the driving force behind Portishead and now an in-demand producer. We've had Barrow on the pod before, but we didn't really need an excuse to have him back, did we, Rosie?
We did not, but we found one.
Ah.
Because Jeff Barrow has joined forces with a couple of Bristolian musicians called Billy Fuller and Matt Williams to form Beak, his new krautrock-sounding group. We wanted to bring him back also because he produced one of our favourite albums of the year, which is the Horror's second album, which he talks about a little bit, and he even teases us for some information about the next Portishead record.
Holy moly.
But before that, here's Beak talking a little bit about the unusual process they had to recording their first album.
It was basically, I think, when we went into the room, we didn't really discuss anything. We just set the gear up and put up some microphones, and we just started to play. And it just seemed to, you know, the first track on the album was the first time we actually started playing. So that moment on the record is us when we first set up the gear, really. And it seemed to work. So we thought, well, that seems to be a good premise to do the rest of the record on.
So you hadn't rehearsed? You hadn't written any songs? This is all just...
I didn't even know these people until that day.
Very true.
Yeah,
we didn't really
know each other, but we didn't know each other.
And
we
so did. How did you come to be in the same room together then if you didn't really know each other?
Well, we played at an Invader Records New Year's Eve party where everyone jammed together for New Year's once, called the Invader Acid Test, about 2 years ago. And Matt was playing the clarinet, Billy was playing the bass, and I was playing drums, and we all kind of like nodded at each other like it was happening, except from, I can't remember nodding at Matt. Did I nod at you at all?
Kicked me in the back of the legs.
Kicked you in the back of the legs.
Yeah.
And I can't help but notice there's no one really stepping up to the mic. There's no singing really on it, or not a great deal of it.
Some singing on it.
When we were recording, obviously we were all playing in a room, and we were all putting the vocals through a little guitar amp, and the guitar amp was actually mic'd up. But because our voices were distorting through the guitar amp, because it isn't really made for vocals, I think when it was going down onto tape, it kind of sounded like that, which is why it's got that sort of murky quality, so you can't really decipher the words, you know.
What were the instruments that you allowed into these strict guidelines?
What we had in the room, basically, anything we had lying around. I mean, Billy was on bass, Jeff was on drums. I had a little fort that I hid behind of keyboards and trumpets.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about Invader Records, because I guess maybe not a lot of people know that you have your own label. How long has it been going, and why did you set one up?
It's been set up since 2003. Myself and a guy called Fat Paul set it up, and Reg came to work for us, and we've released must be kind of almost 20 albums now. I thought there was a lot of really kind of good, interesting music around. Fat Paul was kind of like, has been renowned for working in independent. He had an independent label since he was about 16, I think, or 17, so he seemed like the right guy to kind of join up with.
Most independent labels have a sort of, not a mantra, but a kind of purpose, a reason to exist. What would you say Invader's ethos is as a label?
To lose money and friends.
Is that going well?
Yeah, we're brilliant at it.
When I was listening to the Beak stuff, I kind of got a real krautrock flavour from it. Was that a sort of intentional influence over the music?
I think the krautrock thing is kind of pretty much what we fell into. We're all kind of fans of those kind of bands. What we listened to actually when we did the Beak sessions was a band called The Plastic People of the Universe, which are a Czechoslovakian band that I think were pretty much put inside and started the whole Velvet Revolution from people campaigning to let them out of jail, and they were really interesting, and they, I suppose they're quite like, we're quite like them really, but and then nothing like them really, because we're not Czech and we're not in prison at all. I think the thing is that, you know, like, I think if you put on the radio nowadays, whether it's like, if it's a modern music, whether it's country or western or hip hop, it all sonically sounds the same. It's all been messed around, overproduced, all put into place. There's not a beat out of place. And we just like the idea of kind of like being human. And
so you wanted it to be a bit flawed.
Yeah, and we kind of, well, we had no choice really. I mean, yeah, we're not that good. Average musicianship with feeling. Basically, I mean, like the thing is, we like to kind of like the idea of playing like robots, but actually not being able to play very well. And also just it being in a room, you kind of get a sense of what people were kind of we're kind of doing it. It's not been overanalyzed, and you know, which a lot of music nowadays is, you know, and specifically kind of aimed at a demographic market, you know.
What about next Portishead record?
Oh, yeah, it's out next week.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is it called Forth?
Yeah. Go forth and
Beak
prosper.
Beak did it.
Yeah, Beak did it, yeah. It's all brilliant. No music as such yet. Lots of talking, and maybe a surprise in store for Portishead people who like it.
That's Jeff Barrow and the rest of Beak, and Beak by Beak, that's the album, is out on November the 17th. Okay, time for Feature with No Name. We had a week off last week, so we're back with, well, not with a vengeance, because it's me at the controls, which of course means it's time for a little obscure hip-hop. James Jewett Yancey, also known as J Dilla, died on January the 10th, 2006. Since that date, as with many fallen hip-hop stars, his reputation has grown and grown to the extent that even I have heard of him. Yes, I have to confess to coming late to Dilla. I had some of his music, his production work as the Ummah, a collaboration with the prolific maverick Madlib, but I wasn't too enamoured. His sound was too fiddly, too treble heavy for me. And as the backpack hip-hop fans began to eulogise, so I turned off. But then, this summer, a copy of his posthumously released album Donuts found its way onto my iPod, and my opinion changed entirely. A collection of 31 tracks, each around 60 to 90 seconds in length. It was hip-hop, but not as I knew it. Essentially instrumentals, they took the sort of samples you might find on classic rap records, 60s soul or psychedelia, funk and jazz, and then reformatted them. Old hooks would be made to play new tunes. On top of that would be layered the same ethereal synths that characterises production for other people, and also ghostly vocal samples that would flit glitchily on the edges. One classic donut, which has since been rapped over by Talib Kweli, Q-Tip and Doom amongst others, is a case in point. Lightworks basically contains an advertising jingle, a siren, classical melodies, and percussion that sounds like it was recorded underwater. All of it comes together in a 2-minute package that's as raw as anything by Eric B. and Rakim. With Donuts, Dilla created a new form of his beloved music. He picked up a baton and ran with it, one that no one else has picked up since. Rosie, I've managed to get a cable and a carabiner and tie my arm to a chair.
Right, why?
I don't know why, but I think I'm a little bit stuck.
Right.
So maybe you could, if we go into the Facebook bit now, I'll try and rectify this, and you can start by reading a little bit by Southwood there.
Southwood said, "Living in the Bible Belt, I often think part of the problem is people grew up with the wrong music, i.e. not the Smiths, Bronski Beat, Frankie et al. Nice to hear Holly sounding, well, relaxed. And it's interesting to reflect that the brash and open gayness of Frankie Goes to Hollywood was in part conscious self-promotion, the frisson of excitement as both a path to commercial success and a forcing a shift in attitudes. Nice work if you can get it. Is his art available anywhere online?"
I'm not sure it is for sale, but I think you can view some of it through the usual Google images. I've got the wire down to my wrist. Hang on. Right. Free to read, Miss Wanda. She, we were asked for opinion on album review because it was a new feature. We wanted to get feedback. We wanted to work with you, the listener. Miss Wanda says, definitely keep the album review section. Loved it. So there you go. That's a positive vote. But she goes on to add something in brackets, which I think should cause a little pause for reflection on us all. Although, I could have done without the character assassination of Julia Casablancas. It's no idea if he's boring or not, but it came across as a bit catty.
I don't remember that. Who said that?
I think that was all of us, but we were talking about the kind of boring interviews he does.
I've never interviewed him, so I
don't
know. No,
exactly. I'm just always... I'm
going to blame Alexis on this one.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm always inclined to kiss ass whenever Alexis is around. And just,
but he's not here at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. So let's blame it all on Alexis. Sure. But anyway, yeah, that is a common failing of music journalists, and we'll try and avoid that in future. On Facebook, Rosie...
Chris Jones said, enjoyed the album club. What would be interesting could be polling the listeners to decide which album is reviewed. Put a poll on your Facebook page with a choice of three recent releases. Interaction with your listeners is always a good thing. I like the one sentence summary, very Twitter-like.
Mm. Now, Chris Jones was the guy who kind of originally suggested doing something around albums, so maybe we should try and get that poll thing up there too. We'll look at that for next month. Finally, Christopher McDonald on the blog pointed out that when I said relax was about having a glass of Chardonnay and a foot spa, I was wrong. Apparently, relax is about sex, Rosie. So, now, schooled we have been. All right, get in touch with your thoughts on this week's show at the usual places, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly, or search Music Weekly on Facebook and you'll find us there too. That's just about it for this week, though. I've got time to remind you that you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes or at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. I'd like to pile a huge heap of thanks on the head of Rosie Swash.
I will accept that thanks on
even
my
though
head.
It's a huge pile.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't even breathe at the moment because of that thanks. We'll both be back next Friday, but until then, we'll leave you with a special live track. It's recorded for us by Mumford & Sons. This is called Tim Shell. Goodbye.
Cold is the water, it freezes your already cold mind, already cold, cold mind. And death is at your doorstep, and it will steal your innocence, but it will not steal your substance. But you are not alone in this, and you are not alone in this. As brothers we will stand, and we'll hold your hand, hold your hand. You are the mother, the mother of your baby child, the one to whom you gave life. And you have your choices, and these are what make man great. His ladder to the stars. But you are not alone in this, and you are not alone in this. As brothers we will stand, and we'll hold your hand, hold your hand. I will tell the night and whisper, lose your sight. But I can't move.